Morning.
Morning, Lord.
The story of the prodigal son is probably, I think, one of the most familiar parables of the New Testament. So any pastor who gets up and tries to attack it in a way that lets you hear it differently has got a bit of a challenge ahead of them. It's one of those parables that offers, though, a lot of material for theologians, biblical scholars, and the average person sitting in church. But given the symbolism of the parable, it's part of a trilogy of lost and found parables. We didn't read the full passage from Mark, but it starts off with the parable of the lost sheep, the parable of the lost coin, and then finally the parable of the lost son. So given the symbolism of that parable, it's maybe a little bit odd, I think, that Luke is the only evangelist who relates these parables to us. And yet it's certainly been used over the centuries to describe, the central tenet of Christian faith, that we are all lost, in need of redemption, and fortunate enough to believe in a God of compassion and mercy who will embrace us, in spite of our foibles, if we will recognize our errors and change our ways. So if it's so clearly a message of our need to turn back to God, why is Luke the only one to use it in his narrative of Jesus' ministry? If it's such a powerful image, why didn't the other evangelists pick up on its importance? I think one of the answers to that is that's the nature of parables. They're stories, stories that get us thinking and that leave enough to the imagination, usually, that every individual hearer will take away a unique understanding of the sense and the importance of the lesson that's being taught through this story. Matthew, Mark, and John are the ones most likely to have actually been present when Jesus told these parables, unlike Luke. And the fact that only Luke uses the story of the prodigal son suggests to me that whoever his source was, that person was pulled into this story in ways that the other three evangelists weren't, for some reason. But before I go too far down that road, as a word about Luke's possible source. The generally accepted wisdom is, regarding the Gospels in general, is that Mark is the earliest record we have of Jesus' ministry, and that Matthew, Mark, and Luke are referred to as the Synoptic Gospels because they share a fairly consistent thread of the narrative of Jesus' ministry. They follow a roughly similar chronology, and they contain many of the same elements. Unlike John, that Gospel is a different matter altogether. His chronology doesn't always coincide with the Synoptics. The important elements that he uses aren't the same ones that the Synoptics have, and his overall tone and message is different in quality. But if we accept that the authors of these Gospels are the people whose names they carry, then Luke is the only one of the four who wasn't among the 12 disciples closest to Jesus during his ministry, and so the one least likely to have actually been present when much of the discourse recorded in the Gospels was delivered. Luke then, and possibly some of the others, depended on material provided by others who were present when Jesus spoke. The scholarly consensus seems to be that Mark is writing pretty much entirely from personal experience. While Matthew and John draw on personal experience, and possibly drawing also on Mark's writings, with additional material from a written source named Q. I found it curious to learn that this Q source, there's not, we don't actually have proof of what this source was. There isn't even a clear understanding of why it's called Q. There's some suggestion that it's the first letter of the German word for source, Quelle. But that apparently isn't necessarily the case. Anyway, so it's a bit of a cloud as to what this source might have been. But at any rate, Luke is not writing from personal experience of the things being recorded, but gathering together pieces of the story, perhaps from a myriad of different sources, and perhaps being selective in what he chooses to record. And that, of course, is also true for the other evangelists. They're not providing a daily journal of everything that happened during the 3 years of Jesus' ministry. I suppose if they had today's technology available to them, we might have a 3-year collection of selfies, YouTube posts, and Facebook photos of their Sabbath brunches. But we don't have that. We have instead a highly selective picture of the highlights of that ministry, chosen by 4 men who felt that these pieces of the picture were important and worth preserving for future generations. So each of the evangelists then chooses to include what they feel is central to the story of Jesus. So to get back to the parable of the prodigal son, why is Luke then the only one to include this parable? As I said earlier, I think probably one of the best known, it is probably one of the best known parables, and its importance as a metaphor for God's love and mercy can't be understated. So it's a little perplexing that the other evangelists don't think it's worth recording. I suppose one explanation could be that the other evangelists simply weren't aware of the parable. It could be that Luke got his information from someone who was unknown to the other three. Another explanation could be related more to the nature of parables that I mentioned at the beginning of the meditation. Parables, by their very nature, tend to be open to interpretation to some extent. They tend to leave something to the imagination, and they paint a picture, but it's up to you to focus on the part of the picture that draws you in. Sometimes Jesus explains exactly what he means by his parables, sometimes he doesn't. So I suppose it's possible that the other evangelists weren't particularly inspired by this parable of the prodigal son. Found it too lacking in nuance, too obvious in its explanation. But there is something in the story, though, I think, that touched the person that passed it along to Luke. There must have been. And something about it that made it imperative that Luke include it in his narrative of Jesus' life, even if the other evangelists ignore it. So if you'll indulge me for a bit, I'd like to speculate on what it is about this story that might have affected Luke in a more profound way. There's certainly the image of rejoicing in heaven at the recovery of a lost soul. The parables of the lost sheep and the lost coin are very explicit about this. In Luke's telling of these parables, Jesus is bluntly direct about the parallel happiness of those who found the thing they'd lost, and the happiness of the heavenly hosts at the repentance of the sinner. The prodigal son, as we have it here, isn't quite that explicit about the heavenly rejoicing, but it does come in immediately after the parables of the lost sheep and the lost coin, so the link is obvious enough. The parable of the prodigal son, though, brings in an element that's missing in the other two parables. In this parable, we don't have an uncluttered, straightforward example of celebration of after the recovery of something that's been lost. This parable is a bit messier than that. You lose a sheep and you find it again, you and your friends and family sigh a sigh of relief and celebrate. You lose a coin and find it again, you and your friends and family sigh a sigh of relief and you celebrate. You lose a child because he's turned his back on you and have him come back sometime later because he squandered your generosity towards him. You as a parent may sigh a sigh of relief and celebrate, but I don't think it's difficult to picture that your friends and family may well shake their heads and wonder what's going on. The Leader magazine, that is the source that we use to kind of help us set a tone for the Lenten period in the lead up to Easter, suggests this as part of the understanding of the parable of the lost son, the prodigal son. In the story of the two brothers and their father from Luke 15, the younger brother chooses a series of misguided, self-serving actions and, after exhausting himself, ceases to act on his own accord and falls on the mercy of his father. The older brother's habits are equally misguided and self-serving, but they are habits of inaction and lack of initiative. Both brothers are called to abandon their selfishness and accept the grace of the father's abundance. I don't buy that characterization of the elder brother at all. At all. I don't see any reason to impute to him a lack of initiative or actions driven by self-serving motive. I'm quite capable of seeing a young man who's devoted his life to his father, who's been responsible and diligent in ensuring that the father's legacy be nurtured and protected for future generations, who's been hardworking and constant in his respect and affection for his father, and who's quite understandably bewildered at the reception given his brother. I don't see a selfish and bitter man here, but rather a man who quite reasonably feels betrayed by the father he's been serving all these years. I see a man who may now be questioning his loyalty and his fidelity, and who quite rightly expects his father to show similar gestures of affection to him. And this is where I start to wonder why Luke has included this parable when the other evangelists ignore it, particularly why he includes this piece of the elder brother's reaction. I think it quite likely that when Jesus gave this parable, the focus was probably primarily on the grace of the father towards the younger son, an image of compassion and mercy toward the sinner that we can expect from God. And that reading would certainly fit with the focus of the other two parables of the lost sheep and the lost coin. But if Luke is writing years after the Jesus ministry has ended, if he's writing during the time of Paul's ministry, and at a time when the young Christian movement may be struggling to understand why they're facing rejection and persecution, it makes me wonder if the central character for him isn't rather the elder son, the one who's been faithful, but feels abandoned by his father. If Luke is writing his history of Jesus' ministry with this audience in mind, then I think the grace, affection, and words of reassurance of the father towards the elder son are the parts of the parable that stand out as central for me. Are there words of reassurance here for those who feel that they've been left behind in spite of their faithful consistency and their constancy? I wonder if Luke hasn't honed in on this parable, not as a parable of the prodigal son, although that's the title we've given it, but as a parable of the discouraged older brother. And whether the discouragement comes because of persecution, sickness, or difficulties of any kind, I think there may be a message of hope here for those who struggle with feelings of abandonment and loss. The father is not only reaching out to the son who is lost and then found, he's also reaching out to the son who risks being lost because of his discouragement. In 30 years of working with refugees and asylum seekers, I've met lots of people who wondered where God was when they were in dire straits. People who question whether they were naive to think that they could have come through a particular period relatively unscathed because they trusted that God would protect them. I think the message for them in this parable is not that God welcomes the repentant sinner, but that God reaches out to embrace the child who feels that he or she has been ill-used with words of reassurance that they have not been forgotten or ignored. It's a parable, a story. So it has its limitations. But I think there's a depth of promise in the father's words to the elder son. Child, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours.